the opportunity to connect with people via Zoom, electronically, et cetera, that's actually something really great. So my niece graduated from college in May, and honestly, she's in Arizona. I would never have flown all the way out to Arizona, sorry, for her college graduation. But I was very glad to come in and do a Zoom graduation celebration. And we did pictures and told stories about Zoe. It was all just really nice.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones, sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
I put in this next question because I know there's a story behind it. Catherine has written an intriguing book, Why We Act, Turning Bystanders into Moral Rebels. Catherine, can you tell us the background to that book and the story?
So thanks for that question. It's a really good question. And it's actually a hard story. So backing it up a little bit, I had written a book on positive psychology, on, you know, happiness and health. And I was in the midst of trying to market that particular book when my oldest child started college. So Andrew was, you know, really outgoing, extroverted, you know, ready to be on his own. So we didn't hear really much from him at all for his first 2 weeks of college. Occasionally he'd text with like, how do you do laundry, or can I have more money, or, you know, something like that. We really didn't hear from him. And then about 2 weeks after he started, and this is like about 4 years ago now, I got a call from him one night pretty late. And he said, a student died in my dorm today. And the student was 19 years old. And Andrew then told me the story. And I'm going to tell you the story, but let me be clear. When I tell you the story, it's going to sound familiar, but you probably don't know this story. And it's going to sound familiar because it happens all the time. So the kid was 19. It was a Saturday. He was drinking with friends. He fell and hit his head. And his friends and roommates watched over him for hours because they wanted him to be okay. They checked to make sure he was still breathing. They put him in bed. They strapped a backpack around his shoulders because they didn't want him to roll onto his back and then vomit and then choke to death. So again, they were worried about him. They wanted him to be okay. But what they didn't do for 19 hours was call 911. And when they finally called, he was rushed by ambulance to a local hospital, but it was too late. The hospital kept him alive, so his family could fly in from out of town and be with him when they disconnected him. But he died 19 years old, his first 2 weeks of college. And when my son told me that story, I was just devastated because I could see as a mom, you know, as a person, of course, who works with lots of emotions, I could just see how that could have gone differently if one of those kids had have called. And so I was trying to, you know, write this and market this book on happiness. But all I was thinking about was this tragedy. And so I shifted my focus and I just started trying to understand and read about it and write about it. And that ultimately led to this book, again, called Why We Act, Turning Bystanders into Moral Rebels. Because what I'm hoping in this book is that people will understand the tools that we can all use to step up and not wait 19 hours to call 911.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What was your son's perspective on that later?
So he was really, really shaken by it. And I think he was shaken in part because Andrew was also 19 at the time. Yeah. This student had a younger brother. My son has a younger brother. This student had gone to a boarding school in Massachusetts. My son had gone to a boarding school in Massachusetts. So he just like super identified with this kid. He super, you know, felt like it could be me. And I think for him, it was just 2 weeks into freshman year of college, and you're dealing with this tragedy and this loss. And so the event happened, you know, early September, you know, September 11, 12, 13, something like that. Parents weekend was like the first weekend of October. So we went for parents weekend, and there was a card on the table that said, if you want to write a message to this family, you know, here's the opportunity to do so. And so I wrote something, but it just like, as a mom, I mean, I'm tearing up talking about it now, and it was 4 years ago, but just as a mom, I can't imagine dropping your kid off and 2 weeks later getting this call. And, and as I said to you both, when I start telling that story, many people will say, oh, I heard about that. And they hadn't heard about this kid. I haven't identified where my son went to school or, you know, where this kid was, but here's the thing. It happens all the time. And people say, oh, that's like what happened at that, you know, that Penn State fraternity thing, or that's what happened. And because again, why? Because it happens all the time, right? We hear about it all the time. And those are all kids. You know, the people who don't call 911, they're not bad people. They're not, you know, they're not evil people. They're not serial killers. They just don't know what to do. And although that's an extreme example, you know, my book, and my book talks about that example. I mean, that story that I just told you is the opening to my book. But the reality is, we can all think of times in which we've been in a setting and we haven't done something. So as I was writing this book, I read about, you know, again, so I'm a psychology professor, but I read about the Holocaust and people who looked the other way in Nazi Germany. I read about white people in the civil rights movement who looked the other way when there were lynchings on the public square. The Harvey Weinstein stuff came out as I was writing this book. And I remember a quote in particular from Quentin Tarantino, longtime, you know, Harvey Weinstein collaborator. And here's what it was an interview with the New York Times. And the interviewer said, did you know what was going on? Did you know what Harvey was doing? And this is what Quentin Tarantino said. I knew enough to do more than I did.
Wow.
And what Quentin Tarantino did was nothing. He did nothing. Like lots of people did nothing. Because again, Harvey Weinstein was making or breaking careers. And so my book examines the psychology of inaction, from fraternity hazing to sexual misconduct to corporate fraud, you know, to bullying in schools, because all of it is the same. All of it is driven by the same exact thing, which is this fear of stepping up and doing something. And so my book is really trying to unpack what leads people to not step up, and also to give tools to people that they can use so they don't wait 19 hours to call 911.
So would you say that our natural inclination would be becoming a bystander?
So what the research in psychology and neuroscience shows is that we very much want to fit in. We very much want to fit in with our group. It's part of a human need to belong, et cetera. And so when people are bystanders, it's often because they fear the consequences. You know, maybe the student is just drunk and I'm overreacting. I'm going to look stupid. I'm going to look embarrassed. Maybe that's harmless flirting, not really sexual misconduct. Is that joke racist or homophobic or sexist, or is it funny and I'm, you know, misinterpreting it? So again, people worry about calling out their peers, worry about calling out their family members. They worry about calling out their boss or their friends. And so in many cases, people individually know that's not good. Like that's a problem or that's concerning, but they don't want to appear overly sensitive or stupid or whatever. And so they stay silent, and it's driven by this fear of social rejection. Yes.
Incredible. Incredible. What a story.
Yeah. And I think what's really amazing about that too, is when you heard about the tragedy, it was obviously personal to you and it was, you know, overwhelming and eating at you, but you could have just continued with your happiness and health book, but you didn't. You acted and you took your expertise and you leaned in and you wrote a book. And I think, you know, if we would all kind of consider our expertise in light of the experiences and the passions that we have that organically happen, you know, as our lives unfold, it seems like we would get to, we'd have more writing opportunities if we would really lead in to those two things.
I will say also that working on the book and talking about this subject, you know, again and again, there are two things that have happened just repeatedly. So I've now done, you know, a gazillion, you know, radio interviews and discussions with reporters. And here's what's interesting. Every single time after the interview ends, somebody will say, hey, you know what? I have to tell you about this time. And then they will describe something. And many times it's, 30 years ago, I was in a cafeteria. 20 years ago, I was on a school bus. Whatever. They have all these times they wish they had stepped up, times in which they wish somebody had stepped up to help them, times in which they failed to step up and it's haunted them. So the reality is it's a universal experience of feeling a situation in which like, ooh, I wish I had done something and I didn't. And I will also say that working on the book made me like super conscious of how much am I not stepping up. So I remember there was a time in which I was, again, pre-pandemic, I was in the Atlanta airport, like going through those trams, you know, those tunnels, you know, bottom of the airport. And I was on my phone, you know, talking, you know, changing flights. And I walked by an older man and woman, and the man was vomiting profusely into the trash can. And the woman was like sitting beside him with all this like luggage. So I walked by just chit, 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 you know, whatever. And then I was like, oh, I'm writing this book. A bystander. And I literally hung up the phone. I walked back. And so I'm saying it was not my natural inclination. Like it was like, ooh, you know, whatever. I'd probably been working on the book on the plane. I walked back and I said to her, excuse me, do you need help? And she said, you know, my husband is very sick. And I said, yes, I can tell that. And I'm asking if I can help you. And she said, oh, yes. Could you go get a wheelchair? And I said, sure. So again, that's not me, you know, diving into a burning car and pulling out a baby or you know, doing CPR or whatever. But the idea is that if each of us could just kind of be cautious and aware of our surroundings, I made a difference for that woman who was having a really awful day. And there are many times in which we can not be bystanders and it won't really cost us anything and it'll just make the world better.
It occurs to me that that's something we've all experienced, yet at the same time, we never talk about it.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. And I think that's one of the things that's so interesting is that it becomes this universal experience that we have all had. I remember a few years ago, there was a student in my office. He was a senior on the basketball team. And he said, you know, what's interesting? Every day, somebody in the locker room says something offensive, but sometimes I speak up and sometimes I don't. And what was so interesting to me is that probably every time someone says something offensive, there are a whole lot of other people going, that's offensive, but no one says anything, right? So you can have this, and psychologists call that pluralistic ignorance, where everybody is sort of like, I'm not going to say anything. Even though individually, each of them might be like, that's problematic.
Well, I just mentioned, Catherine, that I feel like you lean in to the world around you, what you see, whether it's the book or that's innate in you, you use your expertise to approach world situations. If we're doing the podcast in the middle of a pandemic, we're going to ask a pandemic-related question, and we are. With the pandemic, what predictions do you have about how psychologically it's affecting us and how it could have lasting effects as we emerge, hopefully, from the pandemic?
Well, I like the optimistic hopefully that you added just there. I will say this is actually something I've given a lot of thought to. I was actually interviewed on a podcast a couple of weeks ago, and the podcast was by a divorce attorney. So his podcast is, isn't that interesting? So something on, you know, helping people, you know, whatever, in terms of their close relationships. And so he and I talked about something that I had observed from a good friend. I have a good friend who is a divorce attorney also, who's a mediator. And early on in the pandemic, we were having them over to dinner, she and her husband. And I said, well, you know, how is your work going? And she said, I am exhausted. So many people are getting divorced. And I'm like, is it because they're just like tired of being with each other? And she said, no. She said, it's basically that divorce is really time consuming. You know, you have to gather up all the financials and this, and you have to make all this. And she said, right, isn't that interesting, Tiffany? And she said, it's basically like people going like, we've been meaning to get divorced. Like we've been meaning to like, and it was literally like, now I got all this time. So we're going to go ahead and get that divorce. And on this podcast, that the divorce attorney who's based in New York City, he said the exact same thing. He said, there were so many people that during the pandemic, but so I'm going to spin this now positive, because I'm not saying that pandemic is going to just all get divorced. And now we have the time to effectuate that. But I think what the pandemic has done is a couple different things. I think one, the opportunity to connect with people via Zoom, electronically, et cetera, that's actually something really great. So my niece graduated from college in May. And honestly, she's in Arizona. I would never have flown all the way out to Arizona, for her college graduation. But I was very glad to come in and do a Zoom graduation celebration. And we did pictures and told stories about Zoe. It was all just really nice. And so I think to some extent, it's actually things that we never would have thought of. I never would have said, let's do a Zoom graduation party. My stepfather turned 86 during the pandemic. We had a Zoom party. Never occurred, you know, to any of us to do that. So I think it's actually an opportunity, you know, in that sense. The other thing which has really struck me is that my teaching has changed. So I've taught since 1997. I've taught for a while. You know, I felt I was pretty good at it. You know, I was just kind of keep doing the same thing. And the pandemic shifted how I teach in so many different ways, including increasing interactivity. Because again, teaching by Zoom, I was like, okay, I've got to do this. You know, I've got to have like discussion questions or we're going to talk about it. I'm not just going to lecture. And now in my classes, I'm implementing a lot of that same stuff. I'm doing more sort of applications assignments. So take something that you've learned and produce something with it as opposed to take an exam on it. So to me, I think it's created more ways to connect in terms of our close relationships of all set types. And at least for me, it's changed how I teach.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Amazing. So when you think about the span of your teaching career, over that time, how have you seen a change in your students in relation to digital devices and the ways that they interact with one another?
Oh, what a good question. So, and we could also talk about professors. I'm old enough that I remember when I was first teaching, there was no PowerPoint. You know, there was no computer. This is not going to make sense. Maybe Brad, you'll know what I'm talking about. Tiffany will have no idea, but I had transparencies. The machine that had like a light. I don't even know what that machine was called.
But overhead projector.
Overhead projector. Yes, I had overhead projector.
I do know.
Do you know what that is?
I do know. Yeah, whiteboard. You have to use the light bulb marker.
Yeah, the light bulb. Yeah. You'd like see it and like it would be projected. And, you know, I'm just like, here's my transparency and here's my transparency and, you know, whatever. But I will say that for me, the biggest shift occurred when students started bringing laptops to class. That it used to be, you know, everybody had a pen and a paper, and sometimes they'd be like, oh, my pen ran out, or I broke my pencil lead. Now, so many of them, you know, are using the computer to take notes. And I sort of feel like that's good and bad. So there may be ways in which that's allowed us to, you know, do different things. I mean, certainly the ease of having them submit papers, you know, without having to go to a printer or whatever. I will also say that I am very mindful that when students are typing, I'm not always sure that they're deep processing it. And so I've had students when they come to my office to ask me a question and I see them just on their computer and they're like, and I think my hypothesis is, and they are reading it. And I'll say, shut the computer. And then I'll be like, I want you to tell me what your hypothesis is. And that's hard for them because they know it on the computer and all they're doing is reading it aloud. And when I tell them, shut the computer and tell me it, it really forces them to figure out if they know it or if they don't.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So to spend that a little bit, how has that impacted their interactions with each other? What do you see the psychological impact of that?
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's probably like many things with technology. I see it as good and I see it as bad. So I will say in part, I think it's very clear that students are comfortable using technology. You know, often when I'm doing something in class and like the volume isn't working, they'll be like, oh no, it's the button by the whatever, you know, like which button is that, you know, or no, on YouTube, there's a different sound. Like they will invariably know, you know, more than I do about it. I will say that it is also, I think for some students, it has created a little bit of a crutch, I'm going to say, because sometimes, you know what, technology doesn't work. Sometimes it's, you know, oh, my computer died and I lost my paper, or, you know, this happened and now it's gone in a way that if it was physically, it would be different. And so I think in that sense, students are relying on it. And sometimes, of course, that works great. But I think there are also times in which that has not been effective. I worry also with technology. I worry about issues of plagiarism being harder, that it can be so tempting, you know, to sort of copy and paste. A few years ago, one of my advisees actually plagiarized her thesis and was caught.
No. Oh,
yeah. Oh. But again, but I think it's the kind of thing where it wouldn't have happened if it was writing it down, right? Because if you write it down, you put in your own words. Whereas I think she was cutting and pasting from electronic documents. It just was sloppy and like didn't kind of go through and check. And so I worry about that too for students sort of not understanding where the line of academic integrity problems falls.
And we see that a lot with our students in terms of a high rate of plagiarism in a particular paper that they've written. Interestingly, though, when you bring that to their attention, it's like, oh, yeah. And they're very willing to do it over.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So it's not a resistance to the idea.
Yeah. When it comes to writing, I'm just curious. I know that right now you're writing with Brad, co-authoring. Actually, let's talk about it. What are you writing?
Oh, well, Brad, you should talk about it.
Well, this has been an interesting journey. And
that's the nicest way you could have described it, Brad. But sure, we'll go with it's been an interesting journey.
Positive psychology people, both of you, all three of us.
That's right. That's right.
Dangerous.
The book is called Creating the Future You, Envision, Pursue, and Persist. Mm. And it's written primarily for students coming into college, first year students.
Okay.
We take the premise that very often students come to college and the conversation is, here's how you can fit into college. We're taking kind of a different approach. And that approach being, here's how you can take college and match it to what you need now and in the future. It's been exciting to work on this. And we believe that sometime in the next two or three decades, it will actually come out and you'll be able to read it.
Oh my.
I will say, if and when it comes out, it's really going to be, I think, just a book that will really, really resonate with students. So I have one son who just graduated from college. I have another son who's a junior in college. I have a daughter who's a senior in high school. And so when I've been working on this book, I'm just channeling them and I'm thinking,
yes,
what could they have used and what do they need to know? And I think that understanding the sort of not, and I'm going to say secrets, but it's not really secrets, right? It's the strategies for how do you succeed in college and giving students insight into what is going to help them succeed is important. And the other thing is that as I often say to my students, you know, college is not a dress rehearsal, right? College is actually your life. And so
right.
I think so many students think like, well, you know, this is just like a dress rehearsal. This is just like practice. And I'm like, no, like, you know, so I had a student literally this morning email me. I have a class that meets at 8:30. And she said, I'm going to go and have breakfast with my mom. And so I'm going to be about 20 minutes late to class today. I'm like,
wow,
right? I forwarded it to my husband and I said, can you imagine ever sending this email to a professor? And so I guess on some level, she was hoping that I would be okay with her absence, or maybe that I would be like, oh, she loves her mom. I mean, I have no idea. It would have been better as far as I'm concerned, overslept. But here's the thing. In she's a senior. This is a senior. So next year, she has a job. She's going to be like, yeah, I'm 20 minutes late to work today. I had breakfast with my mom. I'm sorry I missed part of that partner's meeting. You know, again, that it's not a dress rehearsal. Turning in assignments
exactly right
on time. Proofreading your writing. Showing up. Working as a team. You know, bouncing back from failure. Like, all of these are life skills. So it's not a dress rehearsal. And so this book is about college success, but it's honestly about life success.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Can't wait to read that book.
I think I loved how you both described it as being to put some ownership on the student to craft their own experience or an experience that works for them. And honestly, when I hear you describe it, I feel like colleges and universities that don't embrace that first year experience approach, it's dangerous not to, because they have students are given so many options now with certifications and credentials and all the different kinds of pathways they could take. If they choose college, you're saying, okay, you're in the driver's seat. This is real. You know, go after those resources that you need to succeed. And I think it's very timely. And so timely now, not in 1 to 2 decades. So let me know who I need to address letters to get this published today. I'm so glad I thought to ask about that because I was gonna follow up with what's next for you, Catherine, when it comes to writing, you know, what you're passionate about, your teaching, your expertise. Do you have something coming up?
Well, I'm super excited about this book that we are.
That's what I figured.
Yeah, that is my big project right now, which is exciting. Yes.
And if I could say just on a personal note, Catherine and I have talked a lot, but I have learned so much about her today and just seen a different side of her. I so appreciate that. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you for the opportunity to talk today.
We are going to have links to Catherine's books and more resources, ways that you can connect with her and with Digital to Learn on our website, digitaltolearn.com with the numerical 2. So don't miss out. Visit the website and join us next week for a new episode.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are 3 things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Embrace the future.
Always keep learning.